It is being billed as an early chapter in Clifford Still's groundbreaking path towards abstract expressionism. The legendary painter taught at what was Washington State College and helped create an art colony on the Colville Indian Reservation back in the midst of the Great Depression. The exhibit at the Clifford Still Museum is being curated by Patricia Failing, Professor Emerita, Division of Art History, University of Washington in Seattle, and she's our guest to discuss this chapter in Still's career, its effect on his development, and its influences, if any, on the art of this part of the world. Such a delight to have you here.
Thank you.
How would you describe Clifford Still to someone who's never heard of him?
I would describe him as someone who has a singular place in American modernism, because if you care for his paintings or you don't care for his paintings, if you care for his personality or you don't care for his personality, I think everyone pretty much agrees that his work was unique and, you know, in all that that entails. How do you be unique in the history of modernism? And he really had a singular vision and a singular approach to creative practice. That's what I would point out as perhaps his most distinguishing feature as a historical figure. He's somebody who was an important mentor to other major artists such as Mark Rothko and Barnett Newman and earlier a whole group of San Francisco artists that he worked with when he taught there. And you can kind of hear Still, in a way, talking in the background to people like Rothko and Newman as they're developing their work. They make certain kinds of decisions, they consider certain kinds of modes of practice that seem to be in sort of conversation and dialogue with some of Still's ideas. So he is an important historical figure for them. His discussions, contacts, influence with other major practitioners as well.
There's a quote that I would paraphrase. I don't know the exact quote, but it was by Jackson Pollock, who said, "Clifford Still makes us all look academic."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, allegedly Pollock said that.
Yeah.
And he said that in the context of a time in which lots of the New York artists were really trying to figure out how to really get away from symbolism and representational practice and move in a very singularly, in a direction in which they weren't relying on those practices anymore. And it sounds very simple, but, you know, how do you do that? I mean, Pollock was a figurative painter for most of his career. And, you know, so was Willem de Kooning. And Rothko certainly started out that way, too. So at the point when they're all sort of mutually, you imagine them in conversation about these things, whether they're through their work or indirectly, then all of a sudden Clifford Still pops on the scene, seeming to have solved the problem. And that's the context in which that academic quote came up.
That's the solution. What was the solution?
His solution?
Yeah.
Well, again, this is part of what makes, I think, Clifford Still is this kind of unique figure. The way I used to explain this to students, I mean, when you look at, let's say when you look at early Jackson Pollock paintings, you see Jackson Pollock and you see abstract surrealism. You know, it's his variation of, it's his interpretation of, very distinctive, but, you know, you can certainly see that there's an interplay there. What I think Clifford Still was working on is a form of painting. When you looked at it, you only saw Clifford Still. You didn't see a hint of cubism or expressionism or surrealism, which was the hardest one in a way to beat. He wasn't exactly there yet when Pollock made that comment, but he was pretty close.
He was well on his way.
Yeah.
Yeah. The way I came across Clifford Still was a quote that Michael McClure likes to use to describe his own approach to poetry, and that is, demands for communication are presumptuous and irrelevant. One of the first things you said about Still was his personality. So that kind of alludes to his personality of basically not having a lot of concerns about the market, let's put it that way.
No. Certainly not as a mature painter. And that's not what he thought painting was about. He took it very much as a As he used to say, what he wanted to find in painting was a pure instrument of thought. You know, he was thinking about a lot of big metaphysical themes over the years, themes that he thought were connected to higher sorts of mental activities of humans, and that in that sense they were a contribution to, you know, the world and world culture, and that actually this was a morally, exactly how to describe the moral aspect of it, that it was certainly had a moral dimension as an element of practice, and that people who in a way didn't respect the instrument in the same way that he did, he was not very sympathetic with.
He was dismissive of.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. What's an example of that?
Well, he threatened to shoot Mark Rothko. Apparently, this is the story.
I would constitute that as being dismissive, at least.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's obviously one of those friendships which was close, and then, you know, Rothko makes certain decisions that still doesn't approve of, and, you know, it's not only that he doesn't approve of it, but I think he's, in a way, lamenting the lost friendship. And he thought that Rothko basically sold out to the market. And
that was the end of the friendship.
That was the end of the friendship.
Yeah, when did that happen?
That happened in the, kind of gradually at the end of the 40s and into the early 50s.
Yeah. So we're talking 10, 15 years after the Colville days.
Yes.
Yeah.